Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to episode 3 of the Misfit Faith podcast. I'm your host, Jason Stillman. I'm sitting here in my office at home, gloriously arrayed in my blue terry cloth bathrobe that's keeping me warm on this cold winter's day. Before we jump into the show, just a few things. First of all, patreon.com/Jason Stillman. That's the best way to find out more about the work that I'm doing, and that's a great way to support me as well. You'll notice on the page that I list some pretty modest goals, and I share a bit about the kind of work that I'm doing, especially the creating of an online spiritual community where people can connect, where people can share stories, compare war wounds, that kind of thing. I know that there are loads of people out there, and I've talked to many of you, whose stories kind of mirror mine in many ways, where you feel like a bit of an outcast, you feel like a bit of a homeless vagabond, a misfit, an outsider looking in. That's going to be the topic of this episode of the show, but if that is you, then you're the exact person I'm doing this for. And so patreon.com/Jason Stillman, and that will direct you to my website, which is jasonstillman.com, and I would point you in the direction in particular of the membership page on the website. In the coming weeks and months, my goal is to actually begin a membership, a subscription option, where a Misfit Faith community will arise, and it'll take the form of a private Facebook group that you'll have access to. We will go through books together, we'll have live chats, we'll have Q&A, we'll interact, all of that. And so keep your eyes and ears open for more on that. As I have more to tell you, I'll be sharing it with you here. And also you'll notice that there is a mentoring page on my website as well. That's for those of you who desire a bit more access, a bit more one-on-one interaction. I've been doing personal mentoring for about a year, and it's been a blast. I have a great time getting to know the clients that sign up for this. If that's something that you are interested in, drop me a line, let me know, and do it quickly, because obviously there are only a certain amount of hours in the day, and there's only so much of that I can do. And so if that is something you're interested in, let me know. And before I forget, I want to thank two new patrons of the show, both Larry and Cora became patrons of this show this last week, and so thanks you guys so much for that. And without any further ado, let's get on with the show. Those of you who know me will know that one of the biggest touchstones for me when it comes to connecting with the way I feel, with the way others feel, with the world I live in is through music. I've been a huge music fan ever since I was a little kid. I remember turning the dial all the way to the right, growing up in Orange County and discovering 106.7 KROQ. Rock of the 80s, and ever since then, as a 10-year-old, I've been an avid music fan, and a couple of lyrics to songs that have kind of come to my mind during the past week as I've been thinking about the theme for this show. One is by U2 from a pretty unknown track called Winter, in which Bono sings, "The broken and the bruised, the young and the used, the sure and confused, all here." And the other is from The Decemberists, another favorite band of mine, from an album, the first album of theirs I ever got, called Castaways and Cutouts. Colin Molloy, the singer and songwriter, is absolutely brilliant. And in the song, The Youth and Beauty Brigade, he sings, "We're calling all bedwetters and ambulance chasers. Poor picker pockets, bring them in. We're lining up the light loafered and the bored bench warmers, castaways and cutouts, fill it up. Come join the Youth and Beauty Brigade." You know, both of these lyrics sort of bespeak a status that many of us feel of being an outsider. And I've always felt that way. I've always felt like I was either born in the wrong era, born in the wrong century, born on the wrong continent, not satisfied with the status quo. One thing that really hit home for me recently was watching again for the third or fourth time the Woody Allen film Midnight in Paris, starring Owen Wilson and Rachel McAdams and others, in which Gil Pender, the main character, is a writer, and he and his fiance and her parents are on holiday in Paris. And, you know, Gil, he's kind of a Hollywood hack. And though he makes his living writing and he's quite successful writing screenplays, he's not doing what really creatively fuels him. And there's a certain amount of self-loathing involved in it because what he really wants to do is be a novelist. And he, like so many writers and aspiring writers, romanticizes Paris in the 20s. Because if you know anything about the history of literature, Paris in the 20s was kind of the place to be when it comes to being a writer, a poet, a painter. Paris in the 20s was characterized by Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Pablo Picasso and Dali and all these other brilliant minds who would gather together in the cafe bars of Paris and argue and write and compare notes and criticize one another's work. And in the film, Gil romanticizes that epoch. And it's, you know, I'll give you a spoiler. The film's like almost 10 years old now, so too bad. But in the film, he gets magically transported back to that era and is able to rub shoulders with Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Gertrude Stein and all these other brilliant people. And he eventually comes to realize as he meets a woman in the 20s in Paris, as he's transported back there, she catches his eye. She's a girlfriend of both Hemingway and Picasso, beautiful young woman, and yet she romanticizes the Belle Epoque of Paris, the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. That's the time when she wishes she lived. And one thing leads to another. I won't give you the whole plot, but the takeaway of the film, at least it's supposed to be the takeaway of the film, is you can't ever romanticize some period of the past, some golden age, because if you go back to that golden age, they'll wish they were living in some prior age, and it's like this infinite regress. And yet, when I initially saw the film, I walked out of it completely having missed the point, realizing I'd missed the point, thinking to myself, God, I wish I lived in fucking Paris in the 20s. That would have been the best. However, I do understand the point that Woody Allen's trying to make, and I've always felt like that. You know, when I first became a believer in the late 80s, 1990, and when I was in high school at Calvary Chapel High School in Costa Mesa, I remember immediately being drawn to the Jesus People music of the 1960s and thinking to myself, all this kind of shitty, overproduced praise music of today sucks compared to the music back then, back in the 1960s. And, you know, in my defense, my knowledge of church history only stretched back that far, you know, because in my mind, the apostles all died, they were awesome, everything sucked for 2,000 years until Chuck Smith and Calvary Chapel came along in 1965 and sort of set everything back on track. And there was some pretty awesome music from that time. Mustard Seed Faith, Love Song, The Way. These are LPs that I would get from my friend's parents, you know, who were around back then, who had those still sitting in their garage, and I would get them and record them onto cassette and listen to them while driving around in my 1965 VW bus with long hair, wishing I had been born earlier. That same disenchantment with the status quo affected the way I looked at the way the church operated in those days. You know, all the kind of happy clappy, Jesus is my boyfriend, sort of just bullshit, you know, the kind of gospel as this panacea for life. You know, are you sad? Are you down? Are you lonely? Come to Jesus. He'll heal all your problems. He'll fix your life. He'll give you everything you want. All of that kind of triumphalistic American sugary sweet gospel presentation stuff just made me wish I lived back in the past, you know, live in the, I don't know, the 18th century under George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards or whatever. When I became a Presbyterian minister in the mid-2000s, even then, I still felt like an outsider in my own denomination. And don't get me wrong, I was really good at being Presbyterian, you know? I absolutely suck at being Catholic, but being a Presbyterian, I kicked ass at that. And yet, I wanted to live in 16th century Geneva. I wore a Genevan gown when I would administer the liturgy and when I would preach and serve communion. I wore the traditional garb of the Protestant Reformation, the ministers of that time. I was feeling like a fish out of water in my own denomination, in my own moment. And even as a Catholic, I just don't feel guilty anymore about the things that I'm told I'm supposed to feel guilty about. And I don't make any apologies for that. I have a whole chapter in my book about it. I talked about it a bit on last week's episode of this show with Seth Taylor. But the fact is that if you're like me, you have long felt like some sort of spiritual vagabond, pilgrim, exile, sojourner, with no real place to call home. And I want to read a quick excerpt from Misfit Faith along these lines. Misfit Faith seeks to express in words the last gasp of those who feel like religious vagabonds and exiles, with nowhere to really call home, who have realized that they will always, ever, and only be fans of spirituality rather than full-fledged members of the team. Echoing what I said above, a misfit trying to believe is a recipe for disaster, but if the gospel teaches us anything, it's that disaster is where grace happens. Speaking of being a pilgrim, I'm going to see if I can get Jessica Griffith on the phone. She's somebody that I've sort of gotten to know via Facebook over the last year or so, and she's founded a community called the Sick Pilgrim Community, where a bunch of battered and beaten writers, poets, artists sort of gather together and seek to share their stories with one another and encourage one another. So hang on, let me see if I can get Jessica on the phone. All right. Hey, Jessica, welcome to the Misfit Faith podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So talk a little bit about the community that you have started called Sick Pilgrim, because I know it's quite right along the lines of what I've been talking about in this episode. And so I just kind of was hoping you could tell us a bit about that.
Well, Sick Pilgrim started as a blog. I mean, we kind of intended it to be like a poor man's publishing house because we didn't have any money, but we wanted to support writers who were doing spiritual writing that didn't seem to conform to market standards. So, you know, that wasn't lifestyle blogging or branding, that was maybe a little bit darker than what most publishing houses were looking for in terms of their Christian writing, especially. And as we, you know, as we did that, it kind of exploded, and we, the audience for that was so much bigger than we thought it was. I mean, what we'd been given, especially my experience in Christian publishing, you know, I was always being told you can't go too dark. You always have to have the happy ending. You always have to have the redemption at the end of the story. You could never, you know, they told me I couldn't have, I pitched Sick Pilgrim as my own memoir at first. And I was told, you know, you can't have sick in the title. I wanted to do something called the Dark Devotional, where you were allowed to comment on scripture in ways that maybe weren't so neat and tidy. And, that I was told you can't use the word dark in the title. So I just wanted a place where we could do those things, where we could break the publishing rules, because I felt like there's plenty of precedent in Christian tradition to do that. St. John of the Cross, whose feast day is tomorrow and the Dark Night of the Soul, is part of our Christian tradition. The imprecatory Psalms, I'm probably saying that word wrong, is part of our tradition and the Bible. So it all seemed very confusing to me that Christian publishing seems so geared to a sort of like happy, clappy, full solar Christianity, as Barbara Brown Taylor called it. So that's where Sick Pilgrim was born, as this a cheap to free way to give writers a venue to tell the truth about their spiritual lives. Our associate editor, Matt LaFleur, noticed that these friendships were developing in the comments section of the blog, that people wanted to talk to each other about the posts that they were reading. And so it was his idea to start the online community on Facebook, and that grew beyond anything we anticipated. And it even kind of eclipsed the blog, to be honest. A lot of people who are in the online community, I think, sometimes don't even realize we have a blog. And they're really there for the companionship that they've found, because they have been so lonely in their lives, in their faith communities or whatever. They've always felt like they were the only ones who felt the way they feel. And they find this community, and they finally find other people that they can talk to about what they're going through and that can accompany them.
Why do you think it is that so many people, because I'm a part of this community, and I know plenty of other people who are not, but who still feel like kind of spiritual vagabonds, you know, exiles, outsiders, misfits. Like, why do you think it is that so many people these days seem to be feeling this way?
I mean, my experience is mostly with artists and writers and, you know, creative types. And I think that we have, you know, it's just part of the personality type that you feel that you don't fit in most places, but then you add in the Christian and Catholic elements, and then you are really screwed because most of our churches are not investing in the arts or making their artists, who are often their weirdos, feel welcome. So I think that's part of what we attract. I mean, we actually have so many people in the community who are not Christian or who are not members of churches. We have atheists, we have agnostics. I think giving a space for all of those kinds of different kinds of people to interact and just be honest about an attraction to mystery and an attraction to the church that maybe they don't feel comfortable pursuing. I don't think we're giving people that in like concrete, real faith communities for some reason, unless you're Unitarian and then you have it. But like those of us who are Catholic, you know, I don't know where we're going into parish life and finding support for the arts and support for that kind of really deep questioning. And I also think the church in America, I mean, my God, Christianity has become so political and so affiliated with the right wing that so after the last election, we saw a huge uptick in interest in the community. It was a real watershed moment for us, where when we started the blog, we had no intention of being political. And in fact, it was something we wanted to avoid at all costs, because we felt like the blogosphere, the Christian blogosphere, was so politically charged that it wasn't leaving room for discussion or any kind of common ground, you know? So we wanted to avoid being political. And then the election happened and we were like, God, we can't avoid being political. This is crazy. And I think so many people felt that way. It was just a breaking point where you had to pick sides, people who didn't want to pick sides. And then people felt even more left out and even more homeless than they had before, where they felt so many Catholics who had been kind of buying into the whole, well, you have to vote a certain way because of pro-life issues, felt betrayed by the support for a certain candidate. So we gained a lot of followers and a lot of community members immediately after the election, because people just felt like, where can I go to like express my anger and my disappointment and my feelings of betrayal at the way my church has impacted the political landscape in the country?
Yeah. It's maddening, isn't it? That something like 80% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump, and it's almost pushed it's, I know for, speaking personally, it's kind of pushed me to this place of this anger, you know, and I recognize it in myself and I hate it, but everything is political. Like if I see somebody wearing overalls, I assume that they voted for Donald Trump and then I hate them. It's horrible. It's
awful. I know. And I think some of us, you know, wanted to think we were above it all. I think I was definitely one of them. Like I called myself politically homeless for years. I didn't want to be identified with either party. I didn't want to be pigeonholed like that. I didn't want people to make assumptions about me. And it really drove me out of that position because I realized it's a position of privilege to not have to take a stand, to not fight for what you believe to be right and just. That's not okay to me anymore. And I think that was a breaking point for so many, but we'd been trained theologically to believe that we shouldn't be political or that our beliefs are somehow exempt from being political, that we, you know, and people are just working through all of that. And I've seen it happen in the group, over the last year. So I think it's only increased our feelings of isolation, of isolation from our faith communities. So many of us are in churches that don't seem to be representing what we have come through, like books and literature and art, to believe that Catholicism is. And, you know, we're not, like I said, we're not strictly a Catholic community, but we're mostly a group inspired and guided by Catholicism or attraction to Catholicism. So that's where I speak from. But it's just been, it's been so much more isolating. And yet at the same time, you see this sort of groundswell of people coming together. And I think in these little pockets, you know, that's how change happens. And that's how change has always happened in the church. So it does make me hopeful because I see intense questioning and doubt and darkness, but I also see intense faith. There's so much hope in this community, and it's the hope of coming together in real relationship. And I know that we're mostly online, but those online friendships have resulted in real life friendships and meetups across the country and conferences and retreats and events. And they're driven not out of, oh, I want to go see this celebrity blogger, or I want to go and have a retreat with this community of nuns or whatever. It's like, I want to meet this person in real life and let's make a way for this to happen. And these friendships have become real. And so I see, and it just reminds me of, you know, we're using new media and social media in ways that, you know, it gets such a bad rap, but I see it happening in healthy ways that are moving people forward, that are making people think that they've found real life community, that are making people feel hopeful that they can make a difference in the church. And I even see it pushing the needle a little bit in Catholic publishing, which was our intent from the beginning, to show that there is an audience for real life writing, for real honesty about faith, and for traditional Catholic writing, which is not afraid of these issues, which is about social justice and is also about the darkness of the soul, that has never shied away from these things. And it's only been in recent years when we've begun to ape evangelical publishing and the power of positive thinking and the prosperity gospel and all these things have sort of trickled into the Catholic Church that we have shied away from that kind of writing. And I do see it. I do see some people sort of coming around to the fact that, you know, things are so market driven, but there's definitely an audience for it, especially now in the post-Trump landscape where people are like, this can't be real. This can't be what life and faith is. It can't be supporting Roy Moore. That can't be Christianity. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I have a line in my book where I say, sadness is just happiness for deep people.
That's a great line.
You know, that's always the most interesting stuff, is the dark stuff, the despair, the wrestling, the ambiguity, the unknowing. I feel like anybody can do happy. Anybody can do poppy, positive, bubblegum, whatever else. But it's
platitude. It's cliche. You just parrot back what you've heard other people say. But I always feel like the breath, the air come back into the room when someone finally says what everyone else has been thinking. And it happens. I noticed it. Like I said, you know, the people in the community don't often even know that we have a blog. But one of the great things about the community is, as an editor, I've been able to find people just through their posting in the community where I will say, that's an essay. That's a blog post. That's a book idea. I mean, they don't even realize that just by telling the truth, they're speaking, because they tell their story in a post and then, you know, immediately 35 people are commenting on it like, me too. Thank God somebody finally said it. Thank God somebody finally expressed these feelings that I haven't felt comfortable saying out loud. And we'll be running a post tomorrow on Sick Pilgrim for the feast day of St. John of the Cross that just happened, that because somebody was up in the middle of the night writing about what it feels like to be the parent of young children. And it just paired so well with thoughts about the dark night of the soul. So those sorts of things are happening. And I think it makes me feel like, yeah, we're doing what we set out to do in the beginning, which was to give a voice to a different kind of spiritual writing that we actually think is more traditional, but also we've almost unintentionally created a really vibrant community in the process.
So lastly, just as we wrap up, I mean, what would you say to those who might be listening who are not necessarily artistic, they're not writers or poets or anything like that, but they do nevertheless feel sort of as though they're fans, but not true members of the team, you know, they're outsiders looking in. I mean, what's the solution for those people if they identify on some level as Christian and yet they don't really feel at home anywhere? I mean, ought they conform? What's your encouragement for them?
Well, first of all, I would say if you feel that way, you might like check yourself, because you probably are some kind of weirdo artist. You just don't know it yet.
Yeah.
Because it just seems like the more you, that sort of nonconformist personality type, like you may just not have found your medium yet. But even those, you know, we have people in the community who are not artists or writers, but who just find that they're more at home with the type of person that questions. And I lost my train of thought because my son came in the room yelling, but I would say one of the things that we've always said we're committed to is that this is not an end to in itself. I mean, that we do need to be part of our church communities somehow. But this may be kind of a pub crawl on the way back to the church. If you can find a community that feeds you and makes you feel at home, and like maybe that can help you get back into the pews, because some of us are never going to feel at home in the churches that we have available to us in our communities, but we need to be there. Christian community is important. It's essential, but we might need to find it in creative ways, in different ways. You don't have to be an artist or a writer, but you need to maybe think of church a little bit differently than you have in the past. And that your relationships with anyone, and not just another Christian, that these are how you live out the Christian life, by being in relationship with other people. I love Carol Houselander, who is a British mid-century spiritual writer. She wrote often about unconscious Christs and the idea that every single person, you know, Christian or not, just by virtue of being human, is living out the Christ life in some way. And so you have to have this knowledge in you. Thomas Merton said something very similar in a much more positive way in the vision he had in Louisville of everyone shining like the sun. People don't realize they're shining like the sun. Well, Houselander's vision was a little bit more grim, in that she was writing in the midst of the war and seeing horrible suffering all around her at all times, and seeing that we're all living the Christ life in different ways. Some of us are living Christ's suffering. Some of us are living the life of the infant Christ, and we're in need of protection and succor. So thinking about every person we encounter as another image of Christ, is in the image of God, I just think we underestimate the value of that kind of community and overestimate the value of being in a, you know, quote unquote Christian community, being in fellowship with the people of our church, when really what we need to be is in fellowship with every person we meet somehow.
All right. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, I'm thrilled to have been on your show. Thanks for having me.
So Sick Pilgrim is the blog. Check it out. And you guys also, you're on Facebook as well. Is that right?
That's right. We have a Facebook page, Sick Pilgrim. Look it up. Follow us. That would be great.
All right, Jess. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jason.
Hey, Jason. My name is Paul Reynolds. We've communicated a little bit before. I'm a pastor in the PCA, and I've listened to your Drink Against Pastors podcast for a long time. And my question has to do with spiritual abuse, primarily that from authority figures. And you've bounced around to three different major parts of Christianity at this point, from fundamentalist evangelicalism to confessional Presbyterianism to Roman Catholicism. And as a PCA pastor, I have, in my most recent call, encountered some issues of spiritual abuse from a pastor in the PCA who was my senior pastor and had the respect of a lot of guys in the presbytery. So he didn't get in trouble for the stuff that he did to me. But my question is, where in the three places that you've been, have you seen the greatest possibility of spiritual abuse? And having been in all those few places now, what do you think are some ways that spiritual abuse can be most effectively avoided? All right. Thanks very much. Dick Bush out.
Thanks, Paul, for the question. Good to hear from a PCA pastor, as I once was myself. First of all, I wouldn't say I bounced around from fundamentalism to Presbyterianism to Catholicism. The process did take several years, and so I hope I'm not too wishy-washy in that regard. I mean, the quick answer to your question, I'll give you a quick answer, and then I'll give you a little bit more, something a little bit more thoughtful. The quick answer is that I think spiritual abuse is most possible in either kind of megachurch evangelicalism or Catholicism, because both of them share a similar characteristic in that in the case of megachurch evangelicalism, there's usually some sort of rock star pastor who's the kind of demigod, and he's unquestioned and unquestionable. And oftentimes, you know, these guys, often they're thrust into the limelight when they're young, and the power goes to their head. And so they start using church funds to get their wives breast implants, or use church money to buy expensive cars. And these are not examples that I'm just pulling out of nowhere. These are real things that I've seen. I didn't see the breast implants, but I heard about them. In the case of the Catholic Church, obviously you've got a pope and you've got a magisterium filled with bishops who are the, you know, so the story goes, the successors of the apostles. And in many ways, the church unfortunately finds itself in a similar situation where it is unaccountable. It's unaccountable to the people. And this is why you've got the sexual abuse scandals with priests, where a priest will be abusive toward children and then be moved to some other diocese, to some other place, to some other church where he can continue to do that. In the case of Presbyterianism, I would say that if, you know, because it's so democratic, you know, in the sense that the congregation calls the minister, the minister doesn't own the church. The church is run by elders that are chosen by the congregation. Regardless of what you think about that system, insofar as is it biblical or not, it does keep the abuse to a minimum. And it does, you know, I used to say this when I would teach membership classes in my old PCA church. When I would describe and explain our church government, I'd say, look, if somebody wants to be abusive, he can be abusive anywhere he goes. That is a problem with the human heart. However, if someone is desiring to exploit the people of God, if somebody is desiring to abuse their power when it comes to money or whatever else, the Presbyterian Church is like not the best place to go to do that, because we have systems in place with checks and balances that make it hard to pull off those kinds of hijinks. So that's kind of a quick answer, but just to piggyback upon that, and this deserves a lot more time than I have to give it right here. And I'm sure in the membership portion of the website, once that launches, I'll talk about this in greater detail. The way things often work in the Christian world is that we receive truth from on high, right? Whether it's the Bible or the church or some spiritual guru or whoever it is that we invest with the authority to tell us what's true. We take that and then we sort of filter our experiences, we filter what we know, we filter our kind of gut level intuitions through that truth, whether the truth is a dogma or a teaching or whatever it might be. And that's the sort of direction, that's the flow of information in the sort of traditional Christian way of doing things. And what can happen there is we can make ourselves ripe for a kind of spiritual abuse by the truth, as weird as that might sound. And I'm putting truth in quotation marks here. We often find ourselves second-guessing our own experiences, second-guessing what we know about the world, second-guessing what we know about ourselves, and forcing those things to run this gauntlet, you know, to pass through this filter or go through this crucible of truth that comes from outside of ourselves. And what I've suggested to some of my mentoring clients and others, and something I'd really love to unpack, you know, at some point with all of you, is that perhaps it's time to reverse that direction. Perhaps it's time to put the, you know, cart before the horse. Let the tail wag the dogma, as it were. And instead to operate like this. I know certain things are true. I know certain things are true about the world. I know certain things are true about myself. I've experienced certain things. I have certain intuitions. And so rather than mistrust them and filter them through something that comes outside of me, what if I instead mistrust the truth, mistrust the dogma, mistrust the teaching of that spiritual guru that I've been listening to, and instead force those things to be filtered through what I already know about myself, what I already know about the world? Now, a lot more can be said, but one way I think to avoid spiritual abuse and either becoming victims of it ourselves or spiritually abusing others is by doing this very thing. And so if you have a friend in your life and you find out your friend is gay and everything is telling you, whether it's the Pope or whether it's the Bible or whether it's your spiritual leader, everything is telling you from outside of yourself that that person is a horrible person, that person is perverted or deviant or hellbound. But you know this person. You've known this person your whole life. You know that this person is a good person, a quality person, someone who cares for others, someone who loves his neighbor. Why not, rather than being spiritually abusive of him in the name of the truth with a capital T, why not instead filter what you're told from outside of yourself through what you know about this person? And if that means dismissing or rejecting what you're supposed to believe about, say, gay people, then so be it. But if that's what happens, if that's what you do, then you're doing it in the service of love. Love to your neighbor, love to the other. So there you go, Paul. Hope that helps. I realize I sort of rushed through that, but we're running out of time. All right, show's almost over, but before we finish, I just need a minute.
Now it's time for Jason Needs a Minute.
Everything is political now, and I hate it. After 8 years with a president who respected women and who spoke in complete sentences and, like, didn't mock the disabled or brag about grabbing women by the pussy, I guess I just got comfortable. I guess I just presumed upon these standards. Now, I'm no Obama or Hillary fan. Believe me, I never voted for the former, and I held my nose as I cast my ballot for the latter. This is not about them. This is about the petty and petulant, small-minded, small-handed, war-mongering man-baby we have now. Since Trump's election, I find myself forced into the political sphere, since things like racism and misogyny are somehow on the table again in an overt and emboldened way. I find myself struggling with the idea that anyone who voted for him is somehow okay with these things. They may not be racist or misogynist, but they're on the spectrum by their complicity, and I fucking hate what that thought is doing to me. I hate that I hate my neighbor. I hate that I judge people by how I assume they voted. I don't like this person I become, and I fight every day not to be reductionistic because I hate being reduced to one trait myself. Fucking golden rule. Such a pain in the ass.
This has been Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, that's our show, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. To play us out of the episode, this is a song called Heal by a band called Strand of Oaks. It's kind of the only song by them that I really like, but it's pretty bitchin'. So check it out, and we'll see you next week. Later. Black boots, black jeans, black beard, walking down the street.